Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Well, Ann Schwartz is an organic farmer. And she's more than that. She's a leader in the industry. She's a person that people look to because she has experience. She's been involved in many organizations, and she's been willing to share that experience with both beginning farmers and also people that are in associations, who are involved in trying to do work at Washington State University. We're just really delighted that Ann has agreed to be with us on Farm to Table Talk. Ann, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, I'm glad we could have this chance to chat a little bit. I wanted to ask you, first of all, let's just start with the passion for farming itself. What is it that appeals to you about being a farmer?
Well, I would say I always love farming. There are certainly tears shed from time to time, but I think perhaps one of the things about farming is you never stop learning. There's so much to learn, especially when you're a diversified crop farmer like I am, and you're growing so many different kinds of things that get planted over a long period of time. I grow mixed vegetables and raspberries and blueberries on about 10 acres, and been doing it for almost 40 years, so there's certainly challenges, especially for organic farmers. I would say I found my way to farming a little bit by accident. I was studying agriculture at Washington State University in the 70s, trying to get into veterinary medicine. It was difficult for women to get into veterinary medicine in those days. 8 out of 80 students in our graduating class were women. I thought I would pursue a master's and seek a career as an ag extension agent. And along the way, I thought I should work on a farm or two to get myself more familiar from that perspective. I had kind of done seasonal work on farms, but I went to work for a dairy farmer and absolutely fell in love with it. And as it turned out, I wound up being a crop farmer. I live in an incredibly beautiful place, and I wanted to be outside, and it felt like such a good livelihood. And, it's been a wonderful life, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Well, that's great. Well, describe that beautiful place a little bit more. So you're in Washington State, but for those of us that aren't in Washington, what part of the state are you in? And
I'm in the northwest corner of the state, about 40 miles from the Canadian border, maybe 60 miles from the Canadian border and 60 miles from Puget Sound. I'm in the Skagit Valley, in the eastern end of it.
So are you actually in a valley?
But we get a lot of rain, and we get we are surrounded by glacier-covered peaks, and Puget Sound isn't far away, so it's really quite a beautiful place.
It sounds beautiful. Now, what about the climate? Do you get snow there?
Climate with more extremes than along Puget Sound. So we get hotter in the summer, colder in the winter, and a lot more rain.
Now, are you close enough to Seattle that you're able to market some of your products in the Seattle market?
I did for many years. Now, I ship some crops wholesale from time to time, but mostly I sell mostly in the Skagit and Whatcom counties, the county to the north. I grow quite a bit for our local food co-op, and there's a couple of institutional buyers. There's an environmental institute in the North Cascades that I'm one of the main growers for. I sell some to the schools, and I sell to other home delivery businesses, as well as having a small CSA.
Now, one thing that caught my attention is you were saying that you're growing on 10 acres, and I grew up on a farm in Illinois where part of the reason that you leave the farm is that you were faced with needing to get up to several thousand acres to stay there. How hard is it for people to make a living. Again, I'm trying to frame this right, but 10 acres doesn't seem like a lot of acreage to be able to produce a farming income.
I would say it's a challenge. My husband does work off the farm, and he works for the National Park Service.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have good health insurance, and that's a big thing, especially as we age.
Mm-hmm.
But the farm generally does okay, and I have between 3 and 5 employees, and several of them have worked for me for many, many years, and we have a good team, and we can sell everything we can grow. So generally, it pencils out okay.
With your program, you must have a lot of other people come and saying, I want to be able to be in a business like you are, and they're wanting to find out how you made the decisions that you've made. And one decision that you made was to be certified organic. Could you talk about that? I mean, was there a spot where you were at the fork in the road deciding, first of all, whether or not you were going to be organic, and then whether or not you were going to be certified organic?
Well, I'm definitely a child of the 60s. And I grew up on the East Coast. I was certainly affected by Rachel Carson's work and the growing awareness of what we were doing to the environment. I started college at Rutgers and learned a great deal about some of the environmental impacts to the industrialization of our society. I was involved with, you know, the war movement and women's rights and civil rights. And when I moved to Washington State and found myself at Washington State University to finish my undergraduate degree, I was plopped into a completely different situation and started really understanding the long-term impacts to our food supply. I was surrounded by some of the worst soil erosion on the planet going to school in the Palouse region of Washington State, and there were more and more environmental issues from pesticides that were making it into the media. And then I was invited to participate in some of the earliest meetings at Tilth Producers, and I found my tribe. You know, I found people that were really concerned about how they were farming and were really looking to do it gentler and kinder and try to think holistically and naturally about how to grow crops. And as I just fell in love with farming, I realized that it had to be organic. And I was involved with the earliest writing of standards with Tilth Producers back in the 70s and 80s. And then we created a Western Alliance to harmonized standards between California, Oregon, and Washington, and that was happening in the Northeast and Midwest at the same time, and then there was a national effort actually funded by the Pew Charitable Trust to fund leaders from organic farming organizations to come together to create a national discussion about creating standards, and I got involved with writing the federal rule and working with some of the most wonderful people from around the United States as they were working in their corners to try to figure out how to do agriculture better.
Yeah, you know, that's great, Ann. When we get done with the podcast, you need to write the book.
Blobaum has been telling me that for a long time.
No. I mean, you're kind of like at all the right spots. But I have to do a shout-out for apparently our shared generation of baby boomers, because I remember reading Rachel Carson in college. I don't remember what course that we had to read it in, but maybe sociology. I don't know. Do you remember where you encountered Silent Spring?
I was all animal science all the way, so I don't remember.
Yeah.
But I did have to take some environmental ed classes as well, so it was probably that.
Well, you know what? I mean, there's so much attention to millennials these days. I'm almost embarrassed to not be a millennial and, in fact, be a baby boomer. But there were some of those things developments and in a book like Rachel Carson's that stays with you. I mean, I've read thousands of books and forgotten almost all of them, but I still remember that book. And I wonder how many other people like yourself that it that made that kind of impression and had an effect on some of the choices you've made as you've gotten to the point to make choices about farming?
And I'll throw a shout out to two other authors that have profoundly influenced my life, and one of them is Lewis Bromfield, and the other one is, of course, Wendell Berry.
Wendell Berry's got like 57 books that Joe Salatin just pointed out to me of all the books he's written. Joe Salatin's written 10 books, he said, but Wendell Berry is so prolific, and he's had an influence on many people. I remember hearing Michael Pollan say that probably Wendell Berry was the person that got his attention when he started writing about food. And the other person you said?
Lewis Bromfield.
I'm not familiar. What are his books?
He was in Ohio, and he wrote some pivotal books, Malabar Farm and The Farm.
Mm.
He was a colleague of Aldo Leopold,
mm-hmm.
and he wound up, he was a prolific novel writer between the wars, and then purchased this rundown farm and brought it back to health, and wrote tremendously about conservation practices, and if not organic, then certainly biological and system, holistic system thinking.
Well, I'm going to have to put that on my list to,
yes,
to go back
and wonderful writer,
and research.
And go back to him often.
You mentioned Oregon Tilth, and could you explain to listeners what that organization is?
Well, in the earliest days, Tilth was actually inspired by Wendell Berry. Wendell came and spoke at a conference in Spokane, and many of the people there were so inspired. Wendell challenged them to come together and create an organization to talk about this and to talk about careful farming systems. People came from all over the Northwest, and I think at that first conference in Ellensburg, Washington, there was over 2,000 people there, and we've never attracted another conference like that again. And that was before internet, before email, and before faxes even.
2,000 people. What year did you say that was?
That was in 1974.
Wow.
And so the Tilth Association was created, and over time, chapters were created in different regions. And then as each organization grew, they decided to form their own 501c3 organizing systems, and Oregon Tilth became its own, and Seattle Tilth was created. Tilth Producers of Washington was created, and there was a number of chapters in Montana and Idaho and all over Washington and Oregon. And ultimately now, there is one Tilth in Washington State. All the various Tilths just merged the first of this year. And Oregon Tilth has been its own separate entity for a long time, at least 15, 20 years.
Now, which organization structure actually manages the certification program?
In Oregon, it's Oregon Tilth. In Washington, it's the Washington State Department of Agriculture.
So at first it existed as an organization of like-minded people inspired by Wendell Berry back in the mid-70s. Of coming together, and eventually then it the certification became part of the program, but not initially.
Correct. You know, I think everybody started talking about organic farming, and at the time, Rodale was really the source of this information, certainly brought from the founders in Great Britain and Germany. Those visionaries started, you know, creating this discussion, and there was quite a vigorous discussion of what was organic and what was allowed, and then once you were having that discussion, certification followed pretty quickly because there needed to be some kind of verification program to prove the claim.
Well, then early on, you were involved on the Organic Standards Board that was setting the first standards for to be
not
certified
on the
organic?
National Organic Standards Board, no. I served at our state level.
Oh, okay.
And I chaired a national committee of farmers working on organic livestock standards.
Oh.
So I went to a lot of meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in the legislative arena for many years, and I certainly wrote a lot of proposed regulatory language. But I did not actually serve as an NOSB member.
Well, with all that of weighing in, of having opinions on which directions that they should go, you must had a few had wins and losses. I mean, were there times that you just had to hold your nose and say, I'm not really happy where this with this rule is going, but we're just going to have to live with it because it's the best we can do for now?
Oh, yes. And, you know, at some point it was like, you know what, I think I need to go home and take care of my own farm and pay attention to what's going on at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
So I have backed out of so much involvement on the federal rule these days, but certainly one of the most important things to me has been issues around livestock and humane treatment. And though there are many, many successes, and that's probably one of the things I'm most proud about, we have a long way to go. There's still plenty of abuses in especially poultry operations.
Well, I want to circle back to that in a minute, but first I want to, this involvement that you've had at so many different levels, one thing I'm jealous about is that you got invited to the Esalen Institute. For people that aren't aware, it's a quite a place, and it's right down on Big Sur. I've never been invited. I mean, the only way you go there, I checked in with them once, and it sounded like the only opportunity other than signing up for some workshop is that if you wanted to go to their hot tubs at 2 o'clock in the morning, it was open to the public.
Right.
Kind of like, and swimming suits optional. So I thought, I don't think so. But otherwise, I'd never get an invitation to Esalen. So they put a group together, and could you explain? It was called like Elders, and was it organic farming or?
This was their second gathering, and they're going to host a third. And the organizers of it are Elliot Coleman from Maine and Michael Abelman from Salt Spring Island in Vancouver, British Columbia, Washington, British Columbia, Canada. And I was very honored to be invited. The first session 2 years ago was recorded, and there's more and more information about that available now if you Google Agrarian Elders. Deborah Kane Garcia filmed the whole thing, and they've started making some of those clips available, as well as transcripts. This past time, they divvied things up a little bit, and they invited 12 middle-aged farmers, 30-something to 40-somethings, in addition to the 60 to 80-somethings that the elders made up of, and there was about 25 of us. Maybe 30 of us, plus a few observers, and we had a full week of talking about some of the critical issues of the day, and it was truly a life-changing experience. You know, it was an amazing, amazing experience for me.
Well, hope you can put a word in for me someday. I'd like to go. That sounds exciting. What was the, what kind of your takeaway? I mean, it's been a while since you did that one. What was surprising of people getting together and talking about issues facing farming today, and when the elders that you participated in, as you were driving away from Esalen, and you look back at that and you think, well, that was kind of surprising. I didn't expect that to happen, or I didn't expect to come away with, you know, this particular feeling about the gathering.
I think one of the more profound days for me was when we had several hours to speak about farm succession and how challenging that is. My family didn't farm, and I chose not to have children. So my farm is a first and last generation farm. And I don't own the land that I farm. I have a secure long-term lease. So I'll have a farmstead to sell when we're done being here. And there's a business opportunity here without that rented land. But I was in a different situation than a number of the other elders that have much more complicated multi-generation businesses, you know, especially the dairy farmers there and some of the larger produce and crop farmers. And there were the sharing was really quite remarkable, especially for a gathering of people that didn't know each other. It was a difficult sharing. There's real challenges that we haven't learned to address as a society or in policy discussions. And as we think about the various crises that were addressed at that True Cost Conference where you and I met, you know, I think this whole notion of succession and passing the wisdom of agricultural systems on is really quite profound, and there's a lot of pain associated with it. It's not an easy path.
But the good news that I hear from this is that there's a surprising number of people that want to be generous, and that's contrary to many people's expectation, that there are farmers and people that own land currently that would like to figure out or find a way they could help some new people along.
Right.
And I hear that story all across the country.
And we need to foster that and make it easy and gear the training programs so that it's more than the nuts and bolts. It's the there's a psychic connection that is more difficult maybe to match.
Well, let's talk about one more difficulty potentially, and that is neighbors. We still have a situation, as much as organic farming is growing, it's still a small percentage of the production in the United States, again, even though it's growing very, very fast. So people find themselves surrounded with conventional farmers that may be using pesticides and chemicals and GMOs. I mean, from your perspective, how tricky is that coexistence, but even more than that, I think kind of respectful neighboring when organic farmers are right next to conventional farms?
Well, you know, I think Washington State, at least Western Washington especially, we're kind of in a different situation than either Eastern Washington or the Midwest. Our farms are of different scales, and there was and is resurging tremendous production of fresh market produce. Mm-hmm. And it used to be more for processing, but there's also a tremendous seed crop industry in the Maritime Northwest. We're one of the most important seed growing regions in the world for beets and cabbage and spinach. And those crops require extraordinary conviviality, shall we say. They're long-term crops in some situations, and they're so particular that it's pushed growers in the Skagit Valley to have quite a remarkable need to work together. There's a lot of conventional issues as well as organic issues. And so as I've been involved with creating research opportunities for Northwest Washington, one of the boards I sit on is the Northwest Agriculture Research Foundation, and we help fund research programs at our regional WSU Research Center. And in the last 15 years that I've been on that board, the change of how many growers have adopted more biological systems or adopted organic programs, it's really changed in the Northwest. So where I, as an organic farmer, used to suffer really quite rude responses from people, that's completely different now than it was 30 years ago. Now everybody has an organic block, and the demand for organic product is pushing WSU to do more and more, and our own progress at Washington State University is really incredible with, you know, one of the first organic majors in the country and a dedicated group of scientists promoting biological research through the Center for Sustaining Ag and Natural Resources. So we have a pretty unique climate, I think, in Washington State. And although organics is still certainly a small portion, it's an important and growing portion and definitely has more respect than it did 20 years ago.
Well, I think that of the experiences that you have, probably high up there, just right there with farming, is all of these experiences of seeing people come together and grow together and find surprises and find generosity where you might not have expected it. And you have a special story, too. I mean, you literally had a barn burned down and faced it was a considerable setback at the time, but you had a surprise that came from that experience, I believe.
And it was from my involvement on that board. It is an amazing story. We had a fire in the heart of the season. I had just harvested garlic. It was grown on contract. It was all sold. A fan put on it to help ventilate, failed, started the fire. My tractor was in the barn. I wasn't insured for equipment or crop loss because I didn't think that way then. And so we were grossly underinsured. We had just finished building that barn, and since we had just finished it, we hadn't had the insurance brought up to date. So it was an enormous loss, although what the community did around us was incredibly life-changing and was actually put down in a song by a wonderful troubadour named John Pitney from Eugene, Oregon, in his CD called Blue Heron Fly. That's a shameless plug. But anyway, I was at one of those meetings kind of whining about not having the time to find a tractor, and I had borrowed a neighbor's, but it was too small and it wouldn't run my equipment. And the chair of this organization, who is from a family of one of the larger farmers in our valley, heard me talking about needing a tractor, and he just looked at me. He said, "You need a tractor?" I said, "Well, yeah." And he goes, "Oh, well, it'll be there in the morning. Give me directions to your place." And he had one of his crew load up a 50-horsepower tractor and bring it to my farm, which is a 60-mile drive away from his farm. And it was no questions asked. Keep the tractor as long as you need it, and get it when you're done, call me, and I'll come get it. And I was blown away, because this guy would just, you would not have guessed that this person would do that, but he's so dedicated to keeping every farmer out there. It didn't matter that I was a small farmer. It didn't matter that I was an organic farmer. It didn't matter that I was a woman farmer. He wanted to make sure that we didn't have to go under because we couldn't put it all back together quick enough.
You know, and isn't that one of the things you love about agriculture? There's so many good people. And,
absolutely.
You know, we've had so many cases where people think they have to be on one side or the other of an issue. But when you get right down to it, people attached to the land really are driven to try to do the right thing, the best thing they can, and are trying to be generous and helpful. And you actually live that experience, and you're telling us, and you've been able to tell that story, too, and share that story. And I'm sure it's something you share with new farmers getting started, too. And in fact, I'm going to invite you to go back and give that plug again. You were talking about somebody did a song. What is that? What's the name of the song? And could they find it on iTunes or YouTube or somewhere?
Well, I know you can buy the CD from him.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't looked on iTunes.
What's the name of the song?
It's called
or the album?
Blue Heron Fly. My farm name is Blue Heron Farm.
Mm-hmm.
He named his song Blue Heron Fly. And the songwriter is John Pitney from, I think he actually just recently moved, but he was from Eugene, Oregon.
Well, John, way to go. I hope he's writing more good songs.
Oh, he does. His songs are so great. They're all about farming and community. They're so great for singing along. They're so inspirational. Check out John Pitney.
John Pitney. Maybe we need to have our podcast have a musical interlude from John Pitney at some point.
Oh, you would love it. I can't recommend him enough.
And we really appreciate your taking some time to visit with us this morning on Farm to Table Talk. You've had a great story, and we want to talk to you again sometime, but thanks for taking the time to visit with us.
Thank you so much, and we all need to keep working on true costs of food. So that conference we attended was so inspiring. I'll be looking forward to your other interviews with the other participants from that conference.
Thanks for joining the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to listen regularly on SoundCloud or iTunes to Farm to Table Talk.